with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi, I'm Sabine.
And I'm Amanda. Welcome to the 66th episode of Robots. Today we'll be talking about personal robots. Recently, at the IRIS conference in Taipei, I had the chance to talk to Steve Cousins, a particular leader in the field. Steve Cousins is the CEO of Willow Garage, which is a company most well known for the PR2 robot and the robot operating system called ROS.
We'll then be speaking to Moritz Tenorth, who's finishing his PhD at the Technical University in Munich. He'll be telling us about his experience in working with the PR2 and ROS. But first, as always, let's listen to the latest news in robotics from Christine.
Thanks, Sabine. The autonomous Audi TTS Shelley, which you may remember from her previous report, has completed her climb of Pikes Peak Hill in 27 minutes, losing just 10 minutes on an aggressive and skilled human driver. To achieve this feat, the autonomous car, developed by Volkswagen and Stanford, climbed 1,500 meters of dirt, asphalt, and gravel roads through 156 turns. With the development of Shelley, Volkswagen aims at developing autonomous driving technologies that will be able to keep you safely on the road in the event of an emergency. To extend the car's capabilities to higher speeds, Stanford and Volkswagen are now tackling some traditional paved tracks at high speeds. Israeli company Dreambots has created an autonomous mobile massage robot. The palm-sized 240-gram robot is called Weemy. It uses four sprocket-like rubber wheels to drive over your skin. According to the company's website, the massage robot uses unique tilt sensor technology to move without falling off or losing its grip. The robot will be officially introduced at next year's Consumer Electronics Show. Its creators hope for sales in the toy, gift, healthcare, and gadget markets. So far, no pricing information is available. For pictures and videos of Shelley racing up Peak Hill and the Weemy massage robot, have a look at the forum at www.robotspodcast.com/forum.
Thanks, Christine. Steve Cousins is a seasoned executive, entrepreneur, and innovator with a strong track record for managing research and development organizations and realizing a significant return on investment. Prior to joining Willow Garage, Steve was the senior manager of the User-Focused Systems Research Group at the IBM Almaden Research Center, one of the top human-computer interaction research groups in the world. Earlier, Steve managed the Advanced Systems Development Laboratory at the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center.
Okay, so hello, Dr. Cousins, and welcome to Robots.
Hello, nice to be here. Thank you.
Could you please start by presenting yourself to our listeners?
Yes, my name is Steve Cousins, and I'm the president and CEO of Willow Garage. My background is as a computer scientist. I spent some time at Washington University in St. Louis and a PhD at Stanford in human-computer interaction, and went through a number of research labs, Xerox PARC, Interval Research, and IBM, before coming to Willow Garage, where I now do robotics.
Is there any particular history behind the name Willow Garage?
There's actually a lot of history and intuition behind it. The simplest explanation is we're on Willow Road, and the garage is kind of an homage to all the other companies in Silicon Valley that started in garages. We don't actually have a garage, although we did used to park cars in our cafeteria.
See. So what are the main research objectives behind Willow Garage?
Our goal is to found a personal robotics industry and really take robots out of the factories and into personal lives. That's our fundamental goal. So when we look at what are the problems in that, the problems are perception, planning, control some of the classic robotics problems, but the biggest of those is perception. And so when you ask what our research goals are to solve the problems that are necessary to get robots out of factories and computers out of server rooms and get them into, you know, our lives where they can help us.
Okay. You mentioned the term personal robots, which is actually quite a broad term. What exactly is your definition of it, and what are or what should be the limitations of personal robots?
So we use the word personal robot as a parallel to personal computers. And when you think about personal computers, what's unique about that is it's a hardware platform that everybody has access to and you can then do software on. Personal robots should be a platform that you have access to and can use to develop things. And so by parallel, think of the Xerox Alto, which was the first personal computer back in the 70s. There were only a couple thousand of them made, but on that hardware platform was developed the graphical user interface, Windows, menuing, pointing, all those kinds of things. And that fundamental core technology is still in use today, the software. Nobody uses an Alto today. Nobody uses any part of the Alto in any computer today. So the hardware was obsolete almost from the start. So we think of personal robots as an industry that we hope will grow up, and we don't think anything that's out there, not RPR2 or any other robot out there today, is likely to be the one that is going to be, you know, common in everyone's home. But what we have today are software development platforms, hardware that we can develop software on, that we can then use to figure out what are the concepts that we're going to want in the future.
Right. So it's taking personal computers and adding actuators.
If you start to try to get into a definition of what a robot is, you know that that's a rat hole, right? Because that's a very tough one. The best thing we can say is there's this intuition that people have about what robots are and what they want them for, and the most crisp prototype is Rosie from the Jetsons. I like to say that PR2 is like Rosie from the Jetsons without the attitude. Right, and I think that, you know, some kind of a mobile platform that can manipulate objects in the environment, that's human scale, that has computation on board, that is roughly what I would call a personal robot. And you can start to ask, well, what if it doesn't have manipulation? What if it doesn't have arms? Is it still a personal robot? And that's a little bit of a gray area. You know, what if it's only 1 foot tall or 2 feet tall? Is that still a personal robot? And that's a gray area. So I would say that, you know, it's something that you have access to.
Right. Safety is also a recurring issue in personal robotics. How wide do you think the gap is from lab conditions to real home conditions? And what do you think it will take to bridge that gap? How can we address that in research?
That is a very serious concern. And I don't know if you've seen, we have a safety video on our website that we look at some of these issues. The first difference between industrial and personal robots is in the arms themselves. Industrial robots are very stiff and powerful and often very strong. And coming up with arms that are more back drivable, compliant, and that can be around people without fear of, you know, a software glitch knocking somebody's head off, that I think is a really important piece of a personal robot. Ultimately, we want personal robots to be very light. And the robots that we make today are still pretty heavy. The PR2 is a heavier robot than you would like, but it's designed not so much to be the platform that you're going to put in the home, but the platform that you want to develop on. And so there's this other piece of the equation, which is robustness. So the robot doesn't hurt itself, right? So it's safe from people, safe from bad programs. But really, when we talk about safety, we're talking about human safety. And human safety is, you know, you have to assess the risks. We continually assess the risks of the robots that we put out there and try to figure out, you know, what could go wrong. And the more you do that analysis, the more you realize what you need to teach people about how to use them safely, what labels you need to put on the robot, and what you need to inherently change to make it as safe as possible.
Right. You mentioned in your talk here at IROS that one of Willow Garage's main aims is to foster the research community. And in that sense, the PR2 is mainly developed for R&D purposes and academia. Do you still plan to develop and provide various personal robots and with an increasingly dedicated design?
What we're doing at this point is trying to understand what the market is. It's very hard to design a robot without the use case in mind. And so we understand the academic use case. Mm-hmm. In fact, the PR2 was designed by two people who were graduate students who were frustrated that they couldn't get a robot like the PR2. And so they built one. And then they built a bunch of them to give out. So that the problem of understanding where the market is for the next robot, you can guess, but you really want to do some kind of market analysis there. So we've been studying applications, both the applications everybody talks about, like elder care, disabled care, that sort of thing, and also in industrial applications. So, for example, what can you do in terms of making lab automation work better? How can you automate a biology lab? Because that seems like somewhere that there actually could be an application for the PR2, and we're actively looking for other applications of personal robotics. It's okay if the robot that we have today doesn't fit that model. What we want to do is figure out what the requirements are, try to solve the problem. Maybe it's too expensive, the solution we have, but it gives us a path to building the next robot. We haven't started designing what we would call the PR3, whatever comes after PR2. We haven't started designing it, and we won't start designing it until we have a good sense of what it is. We do experiments with sort of point and enhancements of the PR2. So we'll look at alternate grippers, we'll look at alternate sensors, so that we understand what the capabilities are. But right now we're not diving into a new design until we know where we're going.
Right. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about ROS, the open source robot operating system, which is currently supported by Willow Garage. Obviously, this is a very promising project, and I also love the futuristic idea of a robot app store. Yet there are still many challenges, it seems to me, especially when we're dealing with a research community which is using dozens of different hardware platforms and robots. What do you think it will take for this future app store to really take off?
I think that the community, well, so there's a couple things. First of all, it might make sense not to have so many different robots out there in the research community. Right now, we have lots and, as you say, dozens of models because everybody ends up having to build their own because there's not really a market for those robots. So to the extent that we come up with a few more common platforms and make more of those robots available instead of every robot being a one-off, it actually simplifies the problem that you stated. ROS is exciting. ROS is taking off. It actually runs on dozens of robots today. Mm-hmm. And it does that by being a distributed system, a system that's made up of lots of little nodes. And so you can configure a set of nodes for your robot. And that means if you're using a Barrett arm and somebody else is using a Barrett arm, even though you have a different base and a different sensor suite, you can still use the same Barrett driver. You can probably still use the same arm planner. And in fact, the arm planners are generic. One of the things that ROS has inside of it is an abstract robot model, this so-called URDF, the Universal Robot Description Language, or format. And that's very humbly named. Mm-hmm. But the URDF is something that lets you describe. You can describe the PR2 with it. We've described our remote presence robots with it. We've used it to describe a lot of different robots, and people in the community have. And once you describe that, you've now abstracted the form of your robot, and the operating system just deals with it as it is.
Right. So it seems to me that the only problem to solve is how do we get people to converge on one system, or a few?
And so we have a solution to that problem. And our solution is you make a great system, and you make it so that it's not worth anybody's time to go build a different system or to use something else. And, you know, that sounds a little bit arrogant, I guess, but we've spent a lot of energy, and not me personally, but what I'll take credit for is I've hired some very smart people and let them go to town with this. And Brian Gerke, who did Player Stage, so he has experience with a previous one, is leading this project. Ken Connolly, who is an awesome software engineer, has been one of the key architects on this, and a number of other people as well. And the result of that effort has been is a system that we're all very, very proud of. And, you know, as I showed in my talk, there's exponential adoption of this on any number of metrics. And so ROS really is taking off because it's just a great platform, and it provides a lot of value to people. And it's completely open source, so people can use it and change it and do whatever they want to with it. And that value and that community uptake of the software means that it does kind of become the standard.
Right, right. Making the crazy allegory from personal robots to personal computers, we see that we only have two or three operating systems for personal computers today, and already that is quite a lot for the world to handle with all the compatibilities and things running on one but not on the other. Right. It does make sense, actually.
If you go back to the early days of the personal computer, there were actually a lot of operating systems.
Right.
A lot more than three. Because they were easy, right? If you know the story of Microsoft and how they got to be where they are, they apparently sold the idea to IBM. They got IBM to sign up and say, yes, we'll buy it from you. And then they went off and started writing it or acquired something and started adapting it. And they could do that because DOS, by comparison to ROS, right, the disk operating system, as it was called, which was the precursor to Windows, DOS was a very, very simple thing. I mean, conceptually, it was just a file system. There's no, shared memory. None of the complex things in a modern operating system were there. And so that meant that it was conceivable for somebody to go write that for a small team. You know, two or three people could actually put together that software quickly. And if two or three people can do it in Redmond, Washington, they can also do it, in some other place. And that's why you had all of a sudden a number of different operating systems. And the same thing's true in robotics today. And then when somebody comes along and says, hey, I'm really investing in this and I'm going to have something really serious, then that becomes a major player. And that's what we've done with ROS.
Right. So it seems like society and industry have produced hugely successful systems, especially when cooperating in an open and sharing manner. One famous example would be Linux. So using a common robot API as provided by ROS facilitates the use of common data. In that sense, do you think that ROS goes hand in hand with projects such as RoboEarth, where data sets are shared over the World Wide Web and used for machine learning?
I think there's a very clear analogy, and both shared software and shared data are growing up in parallel, as you point out, at the same time. So I think, yeah, absolutely what you said. There is a great need for shared data sets in the community, and they're starting to really appear. What we're starting to see is academic credit given for the effort it takes to create those data sets, and I think that's really important. That'll help the field. Same way that you publish a paper and get credit, you get credit for publishing a data set. And I believe you should also get credit for publishing a significant module as part of the operating system. All these things are intellectual contributions that you're giving to the community. And the community, and that includes the tenure committees, right, should give you credit for those things if they really have impact. You should judge all of the contributions based on impact and scientific merit.
Okay, so I'm coming to my final question. I liked your anecdote about the farther down the road you travel, the farther you can see. Nevertheless, do you have a vision of the future?
Everyone has a vision of the future. What I see right now is what I put on the slide, which, as I pointed out, is probably wrong. But what I see is a world in which we have, in the short term, remote presence robots. I think remote presence robots are going to come relatively quickly. The technological pieces are there. And the value proposition is really clear. You talk about fighting global warming. You talk about reducing fuel consumption. This is a technology that can reduce commutes in a really serious way, allow people to live in a more distributed manner, maybe live where you want to live and work where you want to live without having to live where you need to work. And that's a big change. It allows you to reduce commute. I mean, also it allows you to reduce travel cross country. Because travel cross country, the first time you go to meet somebody, you probably need to go in person. But if you're having to do that regularly, and if you're in a company where you have multiple sites, I think there's a really clear case for using the technology to reduce travel. So to me, that's the next thing. After that, I think remote manipulation. That means allowing me to do something in a place where I'm not. I call that act there, right? The ability to act somewhere else. So in the simplest case is I'm on vacation or I leave for a vacation. I've driven 2 hours from home, and I think, oh, did I shut off the gas, right? Now, I could drive back and check, but if I actually had a robot that could go and turn the knob, maybe I would just do that, right? I would just pull over to the side of the road where I have internet connection and use my computer to talk to a robot that's back in my house that basically takes care of basic chores. Another example is, you know, maybe I want to go away overnight, but I need to be able to feed the cat. Now, you can have a custom cat feeding dish or something, but maybe you can, you know, a general purpose robot may be able to help that and any number of other tasks that I need to do, just simple chores around the house. So I think that that act there ability is one that's going to be the next step. I don't think we know exactly how we need to act in remote locations because we've never had that opportunity. When we start being there, I can tell you one thing that'll be really common. The remote presence robots can't get through doors on their own, right? That's the first thing you need to manipulate is door handles. And then I see after that, the next phase is something more like autonomy, and I don't know what level of autonomy. I don't believe that we're going to solve AI anytime soon, so I believe that you'll have robots that are going along with the model of the world. And you can get a long way on a model of the world. Our robots today navigate around our building without hitting anybody or anything, and they don't recognize chairs and they don't recognize people. All they recognize is obstacles, right? So people are just moving obstacles, right? And chairs are just fixed obstacles. And they just know I don't hit obstacles, right? I assume the floor is basically flat, and I look around and I don't hit anything. And other than that, I just try to match where I am to my map and I go around. It turns out that simple-minded navigation approach, localization approach, works really well. And using that approach, we've been able to do like a marathon indoors, the robot completely autonomously just, you know, going mile after mile without any problem. So that's a simple model of the world. I don't think we're going to have to solve AI to have robots autonomously helping us out. But there's a nice opportunity with things like the Mechanical Turk and some of these crowdsourcing approaches where I think you'll be able to see a robot get stuck and then get out of it by basically asking for help from the internet and maybe anonymous help, right? Maybe there's just a service and people subscribe to the service and they get paid a dollar every time they help a robot out as long as the help is successful, or 50 cents or whatever the right amount is. And somebody's willing to sit there and basically help robots out one after the other as they, you know, get in a situation where they can't recognize the doorknob for whatever reason, or the lights were turned off or whatever. And that kind of situation, I think, is pretty interesting. It's not solving AI, but yet it's getting robots out in the world and potentially letting them be autonomous from the point of view of their owners, even though they're not autonomous in the sense of intelligent.
Right. Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Cousins, for joining us on Robots.
Thank you very much for having me.
Moritz 10 North has been working on making robots understand human environments, such as kitchens, so that they can be useful in a real-world household task, such as making pancakes. He'll also be telling us how the web can be a huge source of information for robots.
Hi, Moritz. Welcome to Robots.
Hi.
Can you please present yourself to our listeners?
Yeah, my name is Moritz 10 North. I'm a PhD student in the group of Michael Bates in the Technical University of Munich in Germany. And we are working mainly in the area of autonomous household robots. So it's about mobile manipulation, mainly in the kitchen scenario. So our robots are supposed to do tasks like set the table, do the dishes, cook simple meals like maybe pancakes or some prepared meals or so. And our general approach is to make robots behave a bit more intelligently by using AI technology help them perform the tasks. So in robotics, many people focus more on the lower level parts like grasping or manipulation or vision and so on. And we are trying to add the higher level of task planning or knowledge representation and so on to make robots really able to do complex tasks in a more efficient and reliable way. And so our main architecture is called CRAM. It's a cognitive robot abstract machine. And this is a programming toolkit or software architecture to program high-level cognitive functions on real physical robots that perform reasonably complex manipulation tasks. So in our lab, we have three manipulation platforms. So one of them is the PR2 from Ruder Garage. Another one is ROSI, a robot we built on our own using the KUKA lightweight arms and shrunk hands and so on. So it's a very dexterous manipulation platform. And then we also have an iCup, a small humanoid robot.
Can you give us an example of what CRAM can do?
So CRAM consists of different components. One of them is a plan language. So it supports to specify high-level plans in a very flexible way, including things like synchronization between different parallel actions, failure handling, failure monitoring, and so on. And it's tightly coupled with NOROP. It's a knowledge base that allows to perform symbolic high-level reasoning on the sensor data, on the percepts of the robot, and also on the plans of the robot. So, the actions that the robot wants to take and did take in the past. And this integration allows the robot to not only perform a predefined action, but to infer based on the current situation and on its current belief state what the best next action is and the best parameterizations of these actions are.
So you implemented NOROB for ROS. First of all, why were you interested in contributing to ROS?
So we started to implement NOROB long before ROS existed. So it's about 3 or 4 years old, or the first parts of that old. But I think 1.5 years ago, we started to put it into ROS and make it available there. So I think it was a very good decision, though it, of course, took some work to do this integration. But ROS really had huge success, and there are lots of people and lots of important research groups using it at the moment, especially many people in this area of mobile manipulation and household robots that we are working in. And since I'm rather on the higher level, I'm not really doing that much with a lower level sensor interfaces or hardware drivers or so. And also the communication middleware, which is one part of ROS, is not really my the most important thing for me. But ROS also comes with a very good build system, for example, a very good package distribution, and that makes it much easier for other people to install your software. And they simply have to download it, have to compile it. ROS automatically compiles all the dependencies and so on. And that's really a great success, that it's much easier to distribute your software, especially complex systems that consist of many different pieces of software. In our group, the long-term goal is to bring AI technology into robotics. And at the moment, there's not really a big community there. And I think to motivate people to actually use AI technology, it's important to provide them with tools that are very easy to use, easy to install, that are well documented, and that really bring them some benefit, immediate benefit. And I think ROS really helps us here to increase the visibility and to provide tools as well.
In the kitchen scenario you were talking about at the beginning, can you give us an example of how all these pieces fit together? So what is used when, in what task?
So an example was, recently we had a demonstration about robots making pancakes. So we had all of our robot platforms work together, and each of them has some specific capabilities that other ones don't have. So, for example, one of them can open the doors and drawers and take things out, and other robots can are very skillful in manipulation and did actually do the pancakes and so on. So we have the planning system that controls the overall action execution, and we have NOROB, for example, for determining which plans to use. So we are using lots of information from the web and try to download task descriptions and translate them into something executable. Then the robot needs knowledge, for example, about the objects that are appear in the task. It needs to know how they look like, if it can recognize them, where it should find them. And for all of these things, it needs detailed knowledge about the different objects. So, for example, it should know that perishable items are usually found in the fridge, or frozen items in the freezer, or in cutlery in a certain drawer, and so on. And this kind of knowledge is what NoRoP provided to the system that is then used in the planning system. And, of course, the planning system controls the perception for recognizing the objects, for calibrating, for example, the spatula in the hand so that it can use it as a tool for detecting the pancake and these sorts of things.
That's really interesting. So you actually use information from the web. Why do that?
If you're talking about formal knowledge processing, it's always easy to hand code this knowledge if you have a very small scenario and a very limited task that you want to achieve. But if you want to scale robots to more general task execution in real households, and they need to perform a lot of tasks in a very different way, and you cannot control the environment, you don't know which objects are in there, and so on. And scaling to these kinds of tasks is really a very difficult thing that requires a lot of knowledge, and manually coding all this knowledge is not really possible. So we are trying to make use of existing sources of knowledge, and one of them is the World Wide Web, where you can find, for example, task instructions like cooking recipes or step-by-step instructions on how to perform tasks. eHow.com and wikihow.com are two websites for that. But you can also find, for example, Wikipedia-like descriptions of what objects are and which properties they have. You can find databases of common sense knowledge, like eggs can break, or if you break an egg, it's going to be a mess. You can find photos of objects in online shops, for example. You can also find information about these objects in the same online shop, like the weight, if it's perishable, the dimensions, and all these kinds of things. And we try to automatically mine this information from the web and make it available to the robot so that it can use this information in an automated way during its task execution to perform its task more flexible and more reliable, and especially to scale towards more realistic tasks.
That's really interesting. It must be very difficult to extract meaningful information for the robot from this diverse source of information.
At the moment, we manually select the web pages that we want to use, so we don't really start a Google search and try to extract information from all the results. But if you specialize in certain kinds of websites and certain kinds of information, then it's really feasible to get at least some information out of it. So especially for the task instructions, of course, it's difficult because they are written in natural language, also colloquial language. They're written for humans, and not everything in there is really meant for being executed. And another issue there is that the authors require a lot of common sense knowledge to understand these things. So, for example, you're never going to find an instruction to turn off the oven after using it, so you only find the instruction to turn on the oven before, and these sorts of things. So you need a lot of knowledge additionally to these task instructions to really make it an executable plan. But on the other hand, it's very difficult to perform these tasks without such knowledge and without the information from the web. So we think it's a reasonable way to go, and we try to get this information into the robot's knowledge base.
So back to NoRoP, how difficult is it to make software which should be adaptable to different types of robots?
So we have the software running on different robots in our lab, and since the high-level control, like CRUM and NoRoP, are not directly linked to the hardware, it's pretty easy actually to port it to a different system. So, for example, in NoRoP, we have a tight integration with the vision system, for example, and the different sensors of the robot so that we can perform reasoning about what the robot is seeing at the moment. But to adapt it to a different platform, you only have to write a reasonably small interface that creates these object perceptions in the knowledge base, and then you can apply the same technology and the same techniques that you had before. Of course, if you go to a new domain, you'll need some new knowledge about these, the specifics of this domain. So at the moment, we mainly have knowledge about the kitchen environment and kitchen tasks.
So generally, what challenges do you see in making a unified framework for robots?
I think there are different challenges. So one of them is, of course, if there's one unified system, then you need to find a way to do open development there, so establish some open development processes that everybody can contribute and that the system best fits everybody's needs. So I think this organization is one of the challenges, that people don't feel excluded from this one. And another one is surely a technical challenge, so having one system that performs best for everything from low-level control and industrial robots to household robots or so, that's probably very difficult to get. Another one is, I think, if the system, or if you have a unified framework, how to deal with it in the long run. So I think it's going to change the way people really do research. So we already noticed with us that there's quite a shift from doing isolated research to doing more software development and software engineering. So if you're publishing software as open source, then you spend a lot of time in really integrating everything into these packages and doing writing documentation and ensuring that everything runs out of the box and stable on different systems and so on, something that you didn't really have to care about as a PhD student before, which is, of course, on the one hand, very good because other people can easily use your software, but on the other hand, of course, it takes some time as well. And another problem is that the easier it gets to reuse other people's software, the easier they can also make use of your software, and the more difficult it probably gets to find a PhD topic that really holds for 3 years. So this accelerated development at the moment, I guess it's probably a challenge people have to deal with at some point because the exchange is much easier. Many people can start from a much higher level, and the experience that is now collected inside one lab and isolated in one lab gets distributed much quicker, and it's much easier for other people to jump on and do research in new fields that were previously occupied by some people. So finding a PhD topic or a topic for a robot lab that really holds for a longer time and that you can work on then will probably be more difficult, or will be different at least from the current situation, I guess.
Do you see any other benefits?
Benefits, of course. I mean, I think they're pretty obvious that it's much easier to exchange code, to reuse other people's code, and really to focus your work on the part of the system that you are interested in. So if you, for example, want to work on manipulation, then you don't have to first build a perception system, but you can simply use a perception system that maybe provides information that is good enough for you and can really focus on the part that you want to do. And I think especially if you're working on higher-level components where you need a lot of parts of the robot really to work properly, to be set up, and you need manipulation, you need navigation, you need object recognition and all these sorts of things. And for building such a system, you either need a large group that covers all these different areas, or you need to be able to reuse other people's code. And I think for that, it's really very helpful. And another aspect is, of course, if you release the code and you release the data, then other people can easily try your system and can evaluate it as well. So instead of just having a video, you could release code that runs in the simulation and people can really see if it's working and how good it's working. So there are completely different opportunities of evaluating robot software.
Generally, what has been your experience in working with ROS?
Oh, yeah. So we found that many parts in ROS are really reasonably well designed. It's really well documented, especially for open source projects in academia. And it's pretty easy to get started. So after a day or two or so, you really have something running and you can dive into that. We found that it's also pretty easy to implement applications using these existing components, though many of them are still rather PR2 specific. So especially if they're written by Willa Gourage, they are not general for any kind of robot. But I think it's definitely a very valuable source of software. So it really speeds up the development of new applications, since you can focus on what you're interested in and don't have to deal with the parts that are required to make it work.
And you actually worked with the PR too. How was that?
I think it's a very good platform. So, of course, it's not the perfect robot. I think it's very difficult to make a robot that suits everybody. But especially for our kind of research, so we are dealing more with a higher level task execution and so. And for that, we like if we don't have to fiddle too much with, for example, the localization or the grass planning and so on. And for the PR2, there are many modules that work reasonably well, at least well enough, and that you can simply use and execute. So it's very fast to develop some high-level applications using the PR2 and the standard ROS components that are there.
Do you think we'll start to see such robots in our kitchen?
I think it's definitely going to take quite some time. So recently there was lots of progress, and I think also ROS really contributed to speed up the development, since people can really start from a much higher level and don't have to deal with many very basic modules in robotics. But robots are still pretty far away from really achieving complex tasks. So they're lacking perception components that can really reliably detect and localize objects of very different kinds. So for textured objects like products, it's still reasonably easy. But if you go, for example, to groceries and foods or salad, for example, it's pretty difficult to detect these sorts of things. The task complexity is definitely a problem, so you want to have a robot do something useful, and for doing that, you need mechanisms how the robot can really acquire plans for these complex tasks, supervise them, do failure handling, adapt over time, and so on. And there we're still pretty far away from really having these robots doing a large set of tasks in the kitchen. But I hope it's going to be possible to have robots that do something useful in maybe 5 or 10 years.
Thanks, Moritz, for being here with us on Robots.
Yeah, thank you.
That's it for today's episode of Robots. For more information on our guests, have a look at our website, www.robotspodcast.com.
Thanks for listening. Hope to see you in 2 weeks. Full Towels with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.